is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody, to the I Have a College Student in the Time of COVID edition of Midrats. My apologies if my audio is a little weak. Let not your heart be troubled, though. My illustrious co-host and guest have good connections, so in tender mercies, perhaps I shall talk less and let everybody else contribute more. But anyway, welcome aboard, everybody. Thank you for joining us for today's Midrats. As I mentioned here, I am here at 0.8 effectiveness, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. If you are with us live, I'd like to invite you to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. There you will find the chat room. Some of the usual suspects will be rolled up in there. And if there are some questions you would like for us to direct to our guests, or if you just have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, that's the perfect place to go to do that. We'll be monitoring it as we go forward for the next hour. And if you need to head off and take care of some business, you can always catch up with the full archive by subscribing to the free podcast over on iTunes, Spreaker, or any other aggregator you may use. And you're not going to miss a minute of today's show because I really think you're going to enjoy it as we discuss a topic we touched on, directly or at least part of previous shows, for most of the last decade, and that's the relentless advance of knowledge and technology. And even though the speed and advance during history can vary, especially when it comes to warfare and national security, you have to at least pace that advance. But if you really want to have an extra head start when the inevitable conflict comes, you want to be ahead of that curve. And there are lots of false starts, things that work out that actually don't, things that you don't think will work out that do, but you have to experiment, and you have to have a structure, a bureaucracy, and perhaps more importantly, a mindset that enables those opportunities not just to be discovered, but then to be brought forward and actualized. It doesn't happen in a week, and it sure doesn't happen in a POM cycle. It's a long-term struggle. And today, as we reach another quickening of the technology growth, when we look at automated systems, artificial intelligence, and other cutting-edge technology, that all you have to do is look at a Soyuz capsule when it goes up to the International Space Station, or what happened yesterday when SpaceX did. Technology can come around a corner and really surprise you where it is. And that's what we're going to talk about today, not just for the U.S., but for our allies, but for China and other rising powers as well. And our guest is going to be a long-term player in the national security arena. He's going to be Chris Broz, and we're going to be discussing some of the issues that he brings up in his latest book, The Kill Chain, Defending America and the Future of High-Tech Warfare. And just as a backgrounder, I mentioned he's been around for a while, and we'll get into some of that. But right now, he spends most of his time as the Chief Strategy Officer at Anduril Industries. It's a technology startup that develops national defense capabilities. And he's also a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Chris, welcome to Midrats.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
Really appreciate it. I think we have, for the listeners that haven't read the book, you can find a link over at the show page, but I think we probably do a week of 4-hour shows on your book. There's a lot there. And for the listeners that may not have read anything on this is the first time they're coming across the book, I want you to give an opportunity to kind of define a few terms in the scope of the book, specifically two items. First of all, in your title, you use the phrase kill chain, and a lot of people might have that reaction on the tactical, but it's not. This is at best operational, but more of a strategic view of the kill chain. And also, there's a lot of hype out there, and you hear it, and I don't know about you, but it makes my eye twitch where people talk about war is new, and all of a sudden, you know, this POM cycle, this exciting new thing has come along. But that's not what we're talking about here, and I think you do a great job in the book of identifying how this is really a long-term, decade-wide concept and understanding and challenge. So if you could please, for the listener, outline how you use the phrase kill chain and also a little bit of your background, because you're not wet behind the ears on the topic.
Sure. Thank you again for the opportunity. I mean, basically, my background is, as you mentioned, I'm currently working at a defense technology startup and doing that for about 18 months. Before that, though, really spent about a decade on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Last 4 years, I was the staff director, helping Senator McCain, then the chairman, kind of run the committee and its operations for the last 4 years. Spent some time at the State Department before that. But, you know, the desire to do the book was really kind of a function of a lot of things that I had been thinking about while I was on the committee, kind of wrestling with these questions and problems about kind of emerging great power challenges and threats, kind of increasing pace of technology, and what it all ultimately is going to mean for the United States military and our defense strategy. So the book was really an effort to, you know, on the one hand, sort of think through this a little bit deeper for myself. You know, I'd spent a lot of time kind of ingesting information, kind of running 100 miles an hour when I was in government, and really wanted an opportunity to step back from that and reflect on sort of what I think a lot of this is going to mean, what the implications are. Part of it, too, was I think it was an attempt to sort of explain this to a more general audience, but to do it in a serious way. I kind of thought about it from the standpoint of, you know, I wanted a book that people like you and your listeners who are very steeped in these ideas, who've been following them for a long time, are more expert than I am, to be able to read it and say, look, this is a serious attempt to grapple with a very uncertain and very challenging set of topics. But on the other hand, you know, I wanted to write a book that my mom and dad could read, because ultimately I think that the kinds of changes that we're going to need to make are going to have to be kind of understandable to people outside of the defense establishment, at least in sort of like, you know, general thrusts and trajectories. Because ultimately I think that type of, you know, kind of impetus or political pressure is what's going to be needed to really make some of these hard choices that we're going to have to make. So ultimately the question was, how are these emerging technologies really going to change the way the U.S. military can operate, how it can build forces differently, particularly in the context of kind of emergence of Chinese military power, you know, kind of what that looks like, what that means, to a lesser extent, you know, obviously Russia, North Korea, Iran, other types of challenges, but primarily that Chinese challenge. The reason I sort of focused on the kill chain, certainly not what I thought I was going to do when I got into it, is that, you know, in a nutshell, my thinking about technology is that, you know, all too often I think we make it into sort of a deus ex machina or like a wizard's wand. You know, certainly I think people, you know, when I was working in government, tended to think that, you know, these were sort of magical technologies or tools that we were somehow just going to add them to the things that we've always had and the ways that we've always used them, and that we're going to immediately be into a better state. And part of my frustration was really wanting to think through, how are things like autonomous systems or artificial intelligence and machine learning going to change the way that the U.S. military can operate? You know, not to do old things better, not to build legacy systems more effectively, but really to think differently about, from an operational standpoint, you know, from a programmatic standpoint, how we can really kind of imagine new approaches to these problems. And, you know, to me, the kill chain was the thing that I kind of settled on, because ultimately, that is the thing that we are trying to accomplish. That is the outcome we are trying to achieve. You know, a lot of my frustration when I worked in the Congress was that we have a process that is very much geared toward inputs. It's very much geared toward the platforms we buy and maintain, the way that we do things. You know, it's very much focused on kind of optimizing and incrementally improving the things that we have. Whereas I think, you know, when you think about it from the standpoint of what are the outcomes that I'm actually trying to accomplish from a military perspective to compete successfully, to deter conflict, to win at war if I have to, you know, that ultimate outcome, in my opinion, is the kill chain. It is the ability to, you know, and I again, sort of abstracted a little bit, I think, to your point about, you know, is it tactically focused or operationally focused? I guess my put on it would be, and I'm prepared to hear a different opinion, you know, my opinion on this is the kill chain is the kill chain, you know, whether it's tactical, operational, or strategic. And, you know, I don't get into the fine fix, target, you know, for me, it's just, it's understanding, it's decision and action. It's understanding what's happening, where are the things that I care about and need to know about, where are the targets, where are friendly forces, just understanding the battle space. It's making decisions about what you want to do, and it's taking actions. So to me, you know, the big question about all these emerging technologies has to be, how do they enable me to more effectively, at greater scale, at greater speed, create kill chains, create sort of networks of systems that can move through the sequential process in a way that allows me to outcompete a competitor?
Yeah, I want to commend you on your book. I think I highlighted this book more than anything I've done since I was in law school. One of the things that people need to focus on is the concern that you and Senator McCain had was that the people who are potential adversaries, China and Russia, have designed their current systems of warfare specifically to defeat what they view as the American way of war as we currently know it. And your book and the thoughts behind it and the people who you, in whose footsteps you follow, in the revolution of military, whatever it's called these days, you know, you're reimagining national defense. And as you do that, you're talking about using new technologies. What are the forces that you have to overcome the inertia that exists in our structure, and who can lead that charge against the "we've always done it this way" mentality?
That's the crux of the matter. I think the answer has to be, and I try to get at this in the book, it has to be a joint effort between the Department of Defense and the Congress. I think all too often in my experience, what frustrated me was that the Department of Defense tended to treat Congress like children. You know, they didn't want to keep them informed. They didn't want to have grown-up conversations with them and present them information, or, you know, just problems that they were wrestling with that they didn't have good answers to. They didn't bring them into that process. And I think, you know, unfortunately, what that led to was all too often, you know, Congress acted like children. We banged on our high chairs. You know, we sort of took it out on the department just because we had the ability to. And to me, you know, it starts with creating a linkage at the top between senior civilian leaders who are elected in the Congress and senior civilian leaders who are confirmed by the Senate to make really difficult, politically impactful, strategically impactful decisions in the Department of Defense. Those two groups of people need to be very much on the same page. I think part of it goes back to what I was just saying as well. We have to focus on the right things. We have to ask the right questions. Again, the reason that I sort of settled on the kill chain as kind of a metaphor for all of this is that is actually the thing that we are trying to accomplish. And I think when you keep that uppermost in mind, everything else begins to sort of get into perspective and sort of you sort of see it in its right, you know, its right perspective, in the sense that, you know, my goal is not to acquire platforms. It's not to achieve a 355 ship Navy or a 386 squadron Air Force. The goal is to have, you know, networked capability, networks of systems that can allow me to, you know, close that kill chain and solve these problems better and faster than our adversaries. That then, I think when you kind of walk the dog back, you can say, okay, well, what are the necessary inputs that I need to accomplish that level of scale and speed, dynamism, flexibility in my operations, and sort of the connections and collaboration of my systems. It may be things that are brand new. It may be things that we've had for 50, 60 years. It may be and likely will be a mixture of old and new. And I think to go to the crux of your question is, I think to me, and that's what I tried to express in the book, is I think that is the way we're going to make this transition, is that, you know, we don't know where we're trying to go in a specific sense. We have a general sense of, I think, where we need to go. I think in a specific sense, creating networks of systems that can close the kill chain is what we need to accomplish. But what is that going to look like? How am I going to make, you know, kind of incremental improvement in that transformational pursuit year over year, palm after palm, budget after budget? I think when you keep the objective in mind, the outcome that you're trying to accomplish, it allows you to be, you know, much more deliberate in terms of figuring out where you're going. And sort of what mixture of systems, what specific programmatic choices and budgetary choices you have to make inside of that one-year cycle that you're operating under, because you're putting everything in its right relief, rather than if you go in without that sense of objective and it's, you know, well, I'm just trying to buy more of these platforms and I want to add some emerging technologies to them, and somehow it's all going to be better than what I've always had. Again, that's sort of an input-focused view that all too often in the Congress and I think in the DOD is sort of the reigning mindset. Not because the people are wrong or bad or, you know, not at all. It's just that everything from an incentive standpoint, as far as how the incentives of the DOD are aligned, the incentives of Congress, obviously also the incentives of industry, drive you into that sort of input mindset, platform-centric mindset, and I'm, you know, to me, that is the thing we kind of need to transcend to put the right goals in the right perspective, so that we can drive at it, you know, incrementally year over year.
That's a perfect lead into a couple of things I highlighted early on in the book. I'm sure my illustrious co-host has done the same with these two, and you stated, and you just kind of rhymed on it there a moment ago, that in our system, we, quote, remain focused on building and buying, unquote. And this is I'm in firm alignment here with you. And this is the harder part, because I think, especially in a military that prioritizes, especially in the Navy, technology, engineering, technical solutions, we're always looking at the next bright, shiny object that comes up on the PowerPoint. You know, what's the technological solution that I can put a funding line to? And that was your quote here, quote, new technologies are important, but not as important as new thinking, unquote. And I was asking myself the same question you brought up before. You know, is it a people? Is it a process? Is it an incentive issue? And I keep stepping on the same little national defense Lego on the carpet, so to speak, as so much of what we do, why we assign people to certain locations, why and how we educate them, how we buy our systems, dates back to 1986's Goldwater Nichols. And that entire framework and everything that's kind of been built up around it, you've spent a lot of time on the Hill. And I've asked this question to previous guests before, you know, is there an appetite? And if so, who are the people on the Hill that could help drive this? But would we be able to move forward if we weren't still thoroughly enmeshed in Goldwater Nichols, and is it time to replace it?
You know, this is a question I've thought a lot about, and certainly worked on a lot when I was in the Congress. Personally, I think we do have to revisit it. More and more, I found myself asking the question of whether we got some fundamental things wrong with Goldwater Nichols. And I'm not prepared to say that we have or we haven't, but I guess what I would describe is what I see as part of the problem. What Goldwater Nichols did was separate the supply of military power and the demand of military power. There were reasons for doing that, and there may still be reasons for maintaining it. The problem is that in that in doing so, you separate people who own the problem and people who own the responsibility for building and fielding the solutions. So what that leads to, in my opinion, is, you know, oftentimes a misalignment of authority and accountability. And I think we get into problems in, frankly, many things when authority for solving problems and accountability for solving problems are misaligned. So, you know, when you look at Indo-PACOM, for example, why is it the case that PACOM commander after PACOM commander has been screaming for a certain set of capabilities that the Congress and the military services have consistently been either failing to deliver or under-delivering? That PACOM commander, Indo-PACOM commander, sorry, I'm still a bit behind the times, owns the responsibility, owns the problem, the operational problem of military operations in that theater. But that person doesn't have the authority to develop capability, field capability, integrate capability. Certainly not to the degree, you know, that the services do. They have a bit to, you know, nibble around the margins. But that ultimately, that responsibility lies with institutions outside of the command. Again, there are reasons for separating that. The problem is that that person is now, you know, kind of relying on the goodwill and support of others to get the things that they need at the speed that they need them. What I find interesting is that when we look at all of the different combatant commands that the Congress primarily has established since Goldwater-Nichols, or sort of concurrently with it, or how we have modified those authorities in the course of the past 30 years. You look at Special Operations Command, you look at Cyber Command, you look at Space Command, or you know, before it now became the Space Force. We set up operational commands with service attributes. You know, we began blending these operational and service responsibilities and authorities. One put on that is that it was just a big accident. We didn't really mean to do it and kind of screwed it up. I actually think it was done intentionally, even if it wasn't done consciously, because there's a recognition that the ability to solve a problem and the responsibility for solving the problem need to go hand in hand to a certain extent. I think in the absence of that, you end up with supply and demand needing to be adjudicated by something like OSD or the Joint Staff. They're going to get it right on certain occasions. They're not going to get it right on many occasions. And I'd put the Congress into that too, for that matter. The question I think I have as I think through where we need to go on Goldwater-Nichols is just whether that structure makes sense, whether it's too rigid, too unresponsive, and frankly too slow to meet the kinds of challenges we're going to have to meet fielding the forces we need to stay ahead of the pacing threats that we're going to have from an operational standpoint.
Well, I've got so many questions. First thing is, when we talk about Goldwater-Nichols, and you're just kind of mentioning how that works, that, you know, we've got a supply and demand problem, but some of those issues are the fact that we stovepipe so much of our military. I mean, we've got assets in the Army that probably belong in the Army. We also have assets in the other services that may belong in the Army. And, you know, is it just, this is nothing to do with your book necessarily, but is it a time, if we're going to rethink our approach to the kill chain, to also rethink assignment of tasks within the services, so that we have, say, the Army providing anti-ship missiles along the line of the Chinese ship killer missiles? Is that, you know, is that something that should be done, can be done, so that we end up with the dispersed, interconnected military web of things that you describe in the book?
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, and perhaps I still do think that, you know, we kind of need to reopen Key West, really have kind of a fundamental roles and missions conversation. I actually think there could be some merit in that. I worry that it'll become, you know, sort of a lot of time and sort of trench warfare and institutional fighting. The kind of the approach that I take in the book is really trying to think about it more from the standpoint of harnessing you know, inter-service rivalry, kind of corporate rivalry, you know, kind of the competition mindset that exists in our system, harnessing it for good. You know, I think that, like, I like that rivalry. I like that competition. I want to see more of it, but I want to see it sort of directed in a constructive way towards solving operational problems better. So for me, again, that's why the kill chain is a helpful, you know, kind of North Star here, if I could say that. It's the thing that we actually have to accomplish. So to your example, if the Navy can more effectively, or if the Army, for example, can more effectively create sea control and sea denial through the employment of land-based fires, if I'm the Secretary of Defense, I might want to put a lot of money into that right now. And that might put some pressure on the other services to say, you know, I want to show up next year and demonstrate that, you know, I have a superior capability, or I'm going to innovate in that period of time to figure out how I can bring some tools and capabilities to the table that are going to provide better options for that Secretary of Defense. Because ultimately, you know, I want more relevance. I want more share of the budget. You know, I want more ability to move my forces forward. I think that's a good thing. I think that, you know, Secretaries of Defense, the Congress should be thinking much more about how to structure sort of real world outcome oriented experimentation demonstrations where you really are now kind of igniting the creative, spirit of the services to compete with one another, to collaborate and team up, you know, to find ways in which industry can team up together to solve those problems better, so that every year you're showing up with better solutions and you're creating incentives with a lot of money at stake for the services, the companies, the labs, whomever, to win a larger share of that budget by virtue of fielding, you know, a more integrated, dynamic, faster, you know, set of capabilities that network together to help human operators make, you know, understand the battle space, make decisions, take actions. So, you know, I would focus it more that way. You know, it may lead into a formal conversation about, you know, we should really sort of assign roles and missions differently than we have them. I'd rather experiment our way into it. I'd rather see what types of capabilities can be brought to bear and then start to make some decisions as to, you know, who should own what or whose mission should own what. But personally, I think the mission should be up for grabs. You know, I think programs should be up for grabs. I think in general, we've got to get out of this mentality that, you know, a mission, a role, a program of record is like, you know, getting tenure at a university, that once you have it, it's forever yours. We've got to find ways to inject more competition into this process so that there's more ability for upstarts and disruptors and innovators, whether they're in government or out of government, to claim these things, missions, programs, et cetera. But you know, in sort of a democratic way, make it very clear to the folks who might have lost out this round, look, don't fear, you know, come back in a year, bring your A game, and you're going to have the ability to compete again on a level playing field based on outcomes with discernible metrics. And, you know, if you win the day next year, you're going to get the money, you're going to get the contract, you're going to get more of that responsibility for the mission. To me, that's a healthy way to fuel or to steer the competitive spirits that exist in our country and our national defense establishment in the direction that we need to go, which is towards solving these operational problems that emerging powers, great powers, are presenting us with.
Let's shift fire from the your point on competition is spot on. And let's shift fire a bit from the guys in uniforms to the guys and gals in business suits and pantsuits and all that other good stuff. Is at the end of the Cold War, you've got some numbers there, and especially when I mentioned the billions of dollars, especially for my friends in Europe, their jaws would drop off. I mean, that's more than their annual defense budget. Anyway, just for a data point, for those that weren't around at the time,
the end of the Cold War, there were 107 major defense powers, and then by the end of the 1990s, there were 5. And you can kind of put a mark in the ground from the results of Perry's Last Supper. And then you also brought up a CIS study that said in that time that We've had 18 programs started and canceled without anything making a shadow on the ramp or displacing water, costing over $15 billion. And it's clear that there's big money and bad thinking, poor execution, almost as if there's a business model out there that let's not actually build and deploy anything, let's just get paid for the research and experimentation. And how do we get that competition on the defense industrial base when you only have a few players, and especially how they sublet certain parts to each other? Is there anybody to compete anymore? How do you incentivize that system?
Yeah, it's another great question. You know, personally, I think that, look, industry responds to incentives. And I think that what has played out in the defense industrial base over the past three decades, and you cited the kind of key facts and figures and metrics that I cite in the book, you know, to add a few, you know, in that period of time, you know, kind of from 2001 to 2015, I mean, you had 17,000 new entrants exit. You had 80% of companies that sought to do business with the U.S. government just leave because it was too hard, it took too long, and it didn't return enough, you know, in terms of revenue for them to remain operational. National defense is always going to be different than the commercial market. We've got to find ways to make it not that much different, or not as different as it has become. So for me, you know, I think the reason we got into this is because of incentives we've created. I think the Department of Defense has created them. Congress has created them. But that's ultimately what has led to, you know, a smaller and smaller number of programs that's created the temptation to make very big technological bets on hopes and dreams of the future. And when those things don't pan out, you end up in, you know, the problem of some of these acquisition programs that you talked about. From my standpoint, you know, we've got to create the incentives to bring new entrants into the department, into the defense industrial base to do this work, and then find ways to, you know, in the classic fashion, right, bridge the valley of death from, you know, that was an interesting prototype, that was an interesting science experiment or demonstration to, you know, that's a $500 million program, that's a $1 billion program. That's the thing that we failed to do. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that, but I don't think that it's impossible to begin to change things. But it's going to be slow, right? I mean, it's the old adage, right? The best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago and right now. It's going to take us a while to do this, and we're going to need some examples of success. Because ultimately, you know, I think this problem that we talk a lot about in Washington of the disconnect between the defense and the technology communities, Washington and Silicon Valley, you know, my own experience, my own belief on this is that I think we're making this problem a lot harder than it needs to be. You know, what new companies want to see from the department is the ability to enable them to build technology that solves problems and then scale it to more users, you know, to larger dollar amounts, which will ultimately generate more revenue for them. As they generate that revenue, as they scale, they can hire more engineers. They can go out onto the private market and raise more investment capital, which, by the way, you know, dwarfs the defense budget many, many times over as far as the dollars that are available, just looking for good things to do. You know, venture capitalists, investors, you know, these are the ultimate capitalists. They are looking for investments that are going to make them a return. Defense is not going to give you the kind of returns that commercial software is going to give you. At the speed that it's going to return it. But it's got to be able to do better than, you know, what traditionally over the past 20 years or so defense has been generating. And I think that's, again, possible if the department is focused more on increasing the speed to get a company on contract, a prototype built, you know, an experimentation or demonstration conducted, and then very quickly start identifying, look, what is that sort of 1% you know, game-changing capability that we need to start scaling very quickly and putting their money where their mouth is. I do believe there's a degree of if you build it, they will come. And, you know, there's a reason that venture capitalists and investors have not been putting money into defense. It's not because they aren't patriotic. It's because they don't believe that it's going to return them, you know, a healthy return on their investment. And unfortunately, 30 years of empirical evidence suggests that they're right. We can change that in terms of how we're spending money, on what we're spending money, the sort of speed at which and the speed at which we can scale those investments. I think once you start doing that, you'll start to see America's best and brightest in terms of engineers and investors, founders of companies, start to think that, look, working in national defense is not only a place where I get to be close to some of the most exciting and hardest problems in the world, but I can actually do well in the process. This is very much, I think, the mindset that we had in the early Cold War, where we knew what the priorities were, you know, getting to space, nuclear weapons, you know, all the technologies that we developed in the early Cold War. We were spending a lot of money on it. It was very clear. And you had a rush of America's best and brightest into those fields of national security because they thought this was a way of doing well by doing good. They were excited and motivated about the problems. And you actually had the ability to, you know, take small companies and grow them into large, successful companies doing defense work. I think it's possible to do that again. We just have to get the incentives right.
Yeah, I was amused by a very small section of your I don't know, maybe it's the next to the last chapter of the book where you talked about turning this into a competition, basically inviting everybody to participate, but not with PowerPoint presentations. You know, so much of defense money has been spent on PowerPoint presentations. It's nice to see that you were arguing in favor of prototypes. But the question I actually have is, what, you know, you've described the system of systems, which a phrase I particularly don't like, but a system under which all our devices, weapon systems, all that will communicate. We get rid of the massive communications nodes. There are a whole bunch of things that you've got in this book, which I hope it comes to pass. The question is, in my mind, what level of trust in a system like that needs to be created, and how are we going to create that level of trust in the users?
In terms of the users, I think that this is what the users want, right? I think the users, you know, I have a quote in the book from a military officer who's a friend of mine. He's like, look, my biggest problem, he told me last year, my biggest problem is none of my things can talk to one another. And I know that he speaks for much of the force in expressing that frustration. The thing that is so frustrating to me is we talk about these emerging technologies as if they're witchcraft or, you know, science fiction or something that are 20 years into the future. And I think the reality is that many of these technologies, most of them, in fact, are technologies that our military, you know, service members use every day in their private lives. You know, the commercial world has in very significant ways and in certain very key technologies just fundamentally outpaced national defense, such that we, I think, now have an experience where you have people who, you know, have gotten used to the ability to have, you know, all the information that they need right at their fingertips all of the time. They have sort of intelligent machines and processes helping them cull through large quantities of data for pieces of information that they find interesting or recommendations that they need or decisions that they might need to make. You know, they have networks of sensors around their homes or their vehicles that interoperate, that share information, that are processed by machine learning. But when they put their uniforms on, it's like they go back 10 years into the past. And I tell the story in the book. You know, I spoke at the Air Force Association a year ago and was on a panel about, you know, advanced battle management and how these emerging technologies will change network warfare. And, you know, we're talking about all of these types of technologies. And the question came from an airman in the audience, room full of 1,000 people. This is all interesting. I mean, paraphrasing, this is all interesting. But the lived experience of the average airman is, you know, multi-hour network outages every single day that leaves that airman disconnected from email and the internet. Whole place blows up in applause. Like, that's actually, I think, the lived experience of where people are at. And, you know, we can kind of make light of it. We can kind of, gnash our teeth over it. But, you know, in an operational sense, you know, that's the kind of thing that leads you to lose custody of a weapon that's coming at you, or to walk into an ambush, or to, find that your base just got hit by cruise missiles because you couldn't identify a threat. You couldn't keep custody of it. You couldn't make a decision fast enough and communicate it fast enough to someone or something that could do something about it. Again, things that we do in the commercial world all the time that, of course, it's going to be different in a defense context. It just doesn't have to be this different. That's, to me, I think, the thing that I was trying to get in the book. Again, that sort of idea of the kill chain helps to contextualize it, I think, helps us to sort of make sense of what it is we're trying to accomplish. To your question of trust, you know, I do think that users are going to trust this technology in net is because they use it already. But in terms of how they're going to develop more trust in things like autonomous systems as they become more intelligent, more capable of doing things on their own, that is a process of trust that's going to have to be built the exact same way that we build trust in any person or thing now, which is a lot of training and a lot of testing. It's the only way that you're ultimately going to become, I think, trusting that something or someone, frankly, is capable and ready to be taken into a life and death situation.
Let's look external a little bit here. We talk about an organization that took a clear-eyed look at what they saw as the future, and I think even from an objective point of view, got, you know, nod your head and give them a pretty good job and relative success. You got to give them credit. Describe for a bit what is the Assassin's Mace and the 995 plan.
Yeah, so if you look at what the Chinese military has done, again, this is not a new story, right? I'm not the world's foremost expert on this. And this is part of what I'm trying to convey in this book, is that a lot of the thinking here, I was actually kind of shocked when I went back and read and reread the things that have been said and written over 25, 30 years. There's a shocking degree to which we're just still saying the same things. And what's, I think, the more interesting question is why we have failed to do as many of those things that we said that were important. I mean, network-centric warfare is a concept from the 90s. You put that next to the, you know, the things that are being said in the National Defense Strategy, you know, kind of JADC, you know, Joint All Domain, Command and Control, Advanced Battle Management, it's kind of the same thing. With respect to Assassin's Mace, the Chinese, I think, learned a lesson after the first Gulf War. They actually sent a team from the PLA into Baghdad. They looked at what Saddam Hussein had, and basically I think they realized that he had many of the same old Soviet military systems and air defenses that they did, and in many cases, you know, Saddam's were more capable. And I think what jarred the Chinese at the time was the recognition that the United States military did not, you know, sort of defeat every system that the Iraqis put into the field. They reached into Iraq and destroyed its ability to fight. And I think in the Chinese mind at the time, there was the recognition that if they could do this to Iraq, they could do this to us. And they set out very deliberately, you know, sort of shortly thereafter, not to play the same game that the United States has played, but to play a different game. And to your point earlier on the show, to build military capabilities that would call into question the assumptions on which the United States military has been built and the ways in which it operates and projects power. And they went about it very deliberately. So, you know, Assassin's Mace in, you know, kind of Chinese history are weapons that weaker adversaries use to, you know, to prevail over stronger adversaries. I mean, it's like David and Goliath, if you want to use that metaphor. So what they did very systematically were build weapons and military systems to call into question the ways in which America projects power. So, you know, that started with long range, intermediate range, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, more advanced supersonic cruise missiles, now eventually, you know, hypersonic weapons, longer range, you know, sensors, over the horizon radar, long range reconnaissance satellites, but again, very focused on operationally taking apart what the United States would present in the event of conflict. You know, looking at our forward bases in the region and looking to take those off the map you know, with long-range weapons and sensors, looking at air power as a critical instrument of American military operations, building very formidable and dense networks of integrated air and missile defense systems, looking at the carrier and the strike group and the carrier air wing as another critical component of American power projection, and looking to try to push that system farther and farther away from China and overwhelm it with larger and larger quantities of lower cost weapons. So, you know, anti-ship ballistic missiles, anti-ship cruise missiles, you know, looking at all of the communications, command and control, intelligence, you know, satellite, space, putting together the sort of suite of capabilities that will allow them to get into those kind of critical means of processing, transmitting information, and disrupting that. You know, Assassin's Mace was their way of, again, not playing the same game that the U.S. military has played, but to disrupt the way the U.S. military has planned to build forces and use them in combat. And, you know, the basic point that I try to make in the book is that, look, China is not 10 feet tall. I'm not trying to give the perspective, the perception that this is hopeless, but I am very much trying to convey that they have made a lot more progress than the average American realizes. And I would argue the average member of Congress. And I think that we're much more vulnerable than many of those Americans realize.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the areas of what is going on now, which I think is a kind of a slow grade warfare. We've got cyber, we got space, we got information ops, we got little green men, we got the what I call fait accompli operations, like the South China Sea or Crimea or Eastern Ukraine. You know, we're not at war with anybody, but it sure does seem like we're at war with somebody when they're invading all our operating systems on both a military and commercial level. And I think you wrote that they had your security information just like they have mine because they got into the OPM system. You know, how are we going to, you know, is the structure you conceive of, how are we going to stop them from infiltrating that? What is the hardening aspect of that we can prevent them from getting a hold of our military internet assets?
Yeah, I mean, I think basically what you're talking about is sort of the proverbial gray zone, how we compete somewhere between, you know, peace and war. And, you know, I think this is something that the department has really kind of come around on, is this idea that it's not, you know, kind of on or off. You know, it's not phase zero, phase four, you know, that where are we right now with China, with Russia? It's like somewhere in between. You know, we're in open conflict in certain areas. You know, it's pretty sporty in others. It's a lot of kicking under the table in other areas. I think it's going to be a mixture of, you know, competition, deterrence. You know, I think with respect to things like cyber, you know, space to a certain extent, I think we are moving to more of a deterrence model or mindset where, you know, we're going to seek to prevent the bad behavior that we have been seeing for a very long time through making it very clear that we have capabilities and a willingness to use them that can return the favor, and really seek to prevent that behavior from happening in the first place. In other areas, we're going to be, you know, competing with one another kind of below that threshold of conflict. And I think that's an area, I don't get into it in depth in my book just because, you know, I was limited in space and time. But I think there's a whole fascinating question around, you know, what are the kinds of capabilities that we need to develop to give us more options to compete below the threshold of just outright conflict? Because I don't think that outright conflict is something that is likely. I think it's feasible, and I worry that, you know, the erosion of conventional deterrence could make that outcome more likely. But I think on a day-to-day basis, you know, we need to be looking at the kinds of capabilities that allow us in some pretty special, deniable, you know, type ways to compete more effectively, gathering information, not just competing in the military domain, but also, like you mentioned, in the information domain, sort of political warfare, irregular warfare, Things that I think, you know, we've actually have done very successfully in the past. So it's to some extent kind of relearning and sort of rebuilding those old muscles. And I think recognizing that, you know, again, strategy is about finding the points of weakness in your competitor and exploiting them. And, you know, I think what we're seeing with China is that a lot of those points of weakness, you know, may not necessarily be in the military dimension. And I make it very clear in my book that, you know, by no means should anyone take away my belief here that all of these problems have a military solution. They absolutely do not. But unless you have that foundation of military power, unless you have that framework of deterrence, and a conventional deterrence, right, not just nuclear deterrence, you're not going to be effective at competing diplomatically, economically, you know, through the information domain, et cetera, winning friends and allies as you would otherwise be. So, you know, I think it's going to be, you know, kind of pretty full spectrum here. And there's a lot of capabilities that we're going to need to develop that allow our operators, that allow, you know, people in our government to compete more effectively at that level.
Well, let's pull that thread a bit about competition. Is,
yep.
You know, we talk for a second about, you know, the vulnerabilities and opportunities of a military version of the Internet of Things. But if you buy into the fact that a lot of the competition that we're having right now is based upon knowledge, technology, information systems, that's all intellect. And if we're really going to compete, if you're looking for the Chinese building strength and capability in the information, economic, and military strains, you have to ask a question, I think, on one of the habits and assumptions we've had internally. When you look at the data from 2019, we had we almost had 370,000 Chinese nationals studying at our universities. And I've done this because I have college-age kids. You go to graduation ceremonies, especially for graduate schools for master's and PhDs in technology, especially the number of citizens that are holding Chinese communist passports that are in our research institutions is absolutely huge. And we have enough record, we could spend all day talking about the industrial espionage and just outright stealing of technology that their nationals have done here when they get access to our system. If we're really going to compete, is that one of the areas that we need to look at from a not just a military national security, but an economic security point of view, if we're going to compete with them? How do you compete with somebody who steals your best ideas?
Yeah, so I'd say a couple things. I think for the longest time, we did make assumptions about sort of linkages and coupling. We probably weren't thinking enough through kind of a competitive mindset, and we've been slow to recognize that China has very much been looking at us through that competitive mindset, through the lens of, you know, stealing intellectual property, harvesting intellectual resources, property from, you know, companies that they invest in, et cetera. I think that is now coming to, you know, beginning to play out. And I think there's sort of this question, this great debate that we're having right now, sort of whether or how much decoupling should occur. I guess the thing that I would say is we need to be certainly mindful of the risks that we're running, you know, when you have someone coming over who wants to do work in a very high profile, important area of technology. Yes, you have to do sort of your due diligence to ensure that, you know, you're letting people in for the right reasons. You're not letting people come through, you know, who have bad intentions, who are going to seek to exploit you. That being said, I mean, I think the flip side on it that I would put is that doesn't mean we should close ourselves off. I actually think it means that we need to do a better job of competing to attract that talent and retain it. We should be trying to create a place where, you know, the best and brightest from China, from Russia, or, you know, pick your other country, want to come here, and they want to stay here, and they're incentivized to stay here and found their businesses here. You know, when you look at Hong Kong, for example, like, I think we have an amazing opportunity right now to say, people who want to leave Hong Kong should have an open door to come to the United States. You know, bring their wealth, bring their knowledge, bring their entrepreneurial spirit, and become American, or at least, you know, seek refuge here until the time has come where they can return to their, you know, return to their homes, and it'll be the way that it has been. You know, it's certainly not where things are going. So again, I think this is one of our greatest sources of strength, and I think it is absolutely true that China in particular has been using it against us. But I think that we need to be very, you know, sort of judicious about how we continue to maximize that source of strength, even as we become more guarded and more competitive in our mindset, lest we end up, I think, actually kind of denying ourselves one of our greatest powers in this long-term competition.
Yeah, somewhere in the book you note the famous statement that budgets are policy. And you go through the story of the Air Force J-STARS program, which they got rid of a program they did not want, even over the objections of some congressional members. And they did it by, as you wrote, effectively selling the idea that what was going to replace it was equally beneficial to the congressional people and their constituents. If budgets are policy, who is going to sell the idea that we need to revamp our military? We need to look at our legacy programs. We need to decide whether we really need, you know, X number of carriers or 355 ships of the size we currently have, or whether we need different things. Who is that? Is there a person? Is this something that the Secretary of Defense and the President have to pitch? Where's the policy makers on this level?
Yeah, it's. I think it's something that is going to have to permeate the decision making of all of the critical parties. So members of Congress, the Department of Defense, and industry are going to need to look at these decisions as inherently having political implications, because they do. And you know, this is, I think, the thing that, you know, I very much try to, you know, underscore in my book, is that look, national defense is not the free market. There are political implications all over. You don't just pick winners and losers sort of through the free market. There's political influence all over this process. And that's just how it always has been, how it is now, and I think forever how it will be. You know, we can bemoan that fact, but we can't deny it. So I think, you know, it means that for people who are trying to affect this type of change, you know, bring new kinds of capabilities into the force, divest from old legacy systems that have outlived their usefulness, there always has to be the political considerations. How is this going to impact key constituencies who could become spoilers? You know, whether it's in Congress, whether it's you know, groups outside, special interest groups, whether it's industry, whether it's frankly people in the department, you know, internal to a military service who don't agree with, you know, the direction that the leadership is trying to go. There's all kinds of ways in which these, you know, forces can align to spoil those decisions and overturn them or slow them down, you know, put stones in the road. It happens all the time. I think the thing that can change that is recognizing that the process of change also has to have a political cast to it. So, you know, one of the examples I write about in the book, you know, is the developmental program in the Air Force, you know, low-cost attritable aircraft. You know, it's now going by the name of Skyborg. You know, one of the companies that has begun building this type of air vehicle decided to put the production facility, first production facility, for what they hope will be kind of a long run of this, or, you know, eventual kind of transition to program of record of this capability. You know, they decided to put that facility in the home state of the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, you know, Senator from Oklahoma, Jim Inhofe. That is a political decision. You got to put that factory somewhere. It's a, in my opinion, a good decision for a company that's trying to create sort of political stakeholders in a capability that they want to transition and scale. Again, people will look at this and say, you know, this is everything that's wrong with our defense system. It's everything that is shoddy and rotten with it. And I look at it and say, no, actually, this is the way that you affect change. You know, good ideas don't win on their merits. You've got to have, you know, an alignment of the political stakeholders, sort of the key people who are going to influence this process. And I think that's to me, ultimately, one of the key ways in which this transition is going to happen from the force we have to the force we need. That force, that new force, as it emerges year after year, it's going to have to be built somewhere. You know, new capabilities like unmanned underwater vehicles and surface vehicles, and, you know, unmanned aircraft. These systems are going to be produced somewhere. We need to think politically. We need to think about ways in which we can make these decisions, not just on the merits of, you know, what do I need to palm for this year? What do I need to get in the budget? But how can I ensure that I'm making these decisions in a way that is going to create political lift for, you know, sort of the sustainability of these choices, so that the change that is going to play out is something that is sustainable, that doesn't is easily get overturned. You know, you've got to create stakeholders in this process, and the way to do that in our system is to build political support for it. That's just how it is. It's a fact that we can't deny.
Well, Chris, we've come to the end of the hour, and I've got I have about a page and a half of other questions, and I know my co-host probably has double that. The best solution for the listeners, if you've enjoyed the last hour, is head on over to Amazon or get your books and look up The Kill Chain, Defending America and the Future of High-Tech Warfare by Chris Brose, or Christian Brose, if you want to be fancy about it. Chris, obviously, thank you for giving us an hour of your time today. And if the listener, in addition to grabbing hold of your book, if they want to keep track of you, what you're studying, what you're looking at, what you're thinking about, or perhaps what you have coming next, where's a good place for them to look?
They can, as you mentioned, you know, still hanging my hat at Carnegie. You can find me there. I'm on Twitter, at CD Bros. You can follow me there. You can hit me direct there. And, in this day and age, I'm not too difficult to find. So, you know, all the different mechanisms for reaching out, you know, would love to hear feedback, would love to hear what I got wrong. Would really welcome the feedback and views of your listeners. It's been an awesome opportunity to be with you, and would love to hear more from your listeners and do it again sometime.
Well, you're welcome back anytime. And Chris, I want to thank you for coming on today. It's been great talking to you.
Awesome. Thank you very much, guys.
You got it. Have a great day, Chris. And for everybody else, thank you very much for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Piccadilly.